Don't you know, we're talking about a revolution. It sounds
Freedom News Hour, Surviving Meltdown. I'm your host, Walt Thiessen, here with co-host Bill Westmiller. Today is Thursday, March 28th, 2013. And today, Bill, we're going to, I hope your passport is in order, because we're going to be flying overseas to Europe and Euroland. We're going to spend about half the show over there because, well, first of all, there's the news from Cyprus that we touched on last week. And we're also going to take a look at what the real inflation rate in the Eurozone really is. It's actually not quite as simple as you might think it is. And then when we're done, I'm hearing somebody dialing in, and then when we're done, we're going to fly back to this side of the Atlantic and maybe take a little quick look over at our friends to the north and find out how rich the Canadians are, and then we're going to take a look at whether or not Ron Paul has ruined his son. And, before we come back, we may actually stop off in Iraq to see how their economy is doing, and then we'll finish off with some zombie economics. So it should be a lot of fun. But we're going to start with Cyprus because, as we reported last week, Cyprus is in the middle of a banking holiday. Doesn't that sound nice? Banking holiday. Of course, it's, what it really means is that they've got the banks closed so they can steal the money. But it sounds so much better to say a bank holiday, so we'll say a bank holiday. And today, the banks reopened again. Woo-hoo! So exciting. Of course, there are limits to it. Like you can only take out the equivalent of $383 a day. That's a 300-euro limit on withdrawals. And there are restrictions on transfers to accounts outside the country because they don't want that Russian money to get away. Bill, I guess it really isn't a surprise how all this is playing out. I think maybe the biggest surprise is how accurate our guesses were.
Yeah, pretty standard stuff. I mean, it's kind of a combination of what they did with Iceland and Ireland. In Iceland, the banks crashed, and so they basically did a reorganization of the banks and put in all kinds of capital controls, and the government's basically running the banking system now. And in Ireland, where they did the confiscation of deposits, and they're still doing it, you know, after years, taking percentage tax on every deposit. So it's a combination of the two things, and it does absolutely nothing. I mean, it postpones the immediate problem, but it basically wipes out any of the large investors that have put their money into Cypriot banks because they were getting fantastic returns.
Mm.
The Cypriot banks were buying Greek bonds and junk bonds pay an enormous profit.
Yes, until they disappear.
Oh, wait a second. That's not supposed to happen. These are governments. They don't collapse.
Yeah, but look at all the money that you make in the meantime. I mean, it's fantastic.
Well, this is one thing that Peter Schiff mentioned. Maybe we'll get to it a little bit later.
Peter, because we're going to do him next anyway, so go ahead.
Yeah, because the point, and I didn't get an opportunity to mention this last week, was that there's some justice in this confiscation of deposits. Because basically the government was encouraging people to put their money into the People's Bank, which the government owned, because they're going to get fantastic high returns over the course of, a decade or whatever, which is what they did. They got enormous, interest rates, enormous appreciation on their deposits. So it's not altogether unfitting that the deposits be confiscated, which means they just made no money instead of having fantastic returns over a decade. So that was the point that Peter Schiff was trying to make.
Well, he was also making another point, and it was the other point that he made that I thought was really quite laughable, and in fact, we emailed about that. But the main point he made, and you can actually see it in a video at YouTube. The video is entitled "Peter Schiff: Cyprus More Honest Than the U.S. by Confiscating Deposits Rather Than Using Inflation," and it was the title that I took issue with, because what the title suggests and what Schiff suggests is that by confiscating the deposits, they won't lose any money to inflation. They won't have the hidden tax built in. But he actually has absolutely no basis for the assumption that there won't be any inflation tax in Cyprus.
No, he was saying it was more honest to just take the money instead of depreciating it.
But it's not. That's my point. It's in addition to depreciating it.
Yeah, it's still depreciating, but...
So here, it's depreciating, and we might have a confiscation. There they have depreciation and a confiscation.
I mean, theoretically, the U.S. government wouldn't have to have any taxes at all if they just printed the money and paid for whatever they wanted to buy with the printed money. Of course, you'd have runaway inflation. You wouldn't have any taxes, though.
That's what leading economists are trying to get them to do anyway.
That's true. Yeah, so anyway, I think the EU has been on the phone with Ben Bernanke, and he's explained to them how they're going to solve this problem. And,
I think they've been on the phone with that. I can't remember what his name is, the economist from the New York Times.
Bergman?
Bergman, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, Mr. Print 'em until it hurts.
Well, you hear echoes of that in Europe right now.
There was a
minister of the Deutsche Bank who said, you know, we just turn on the printing press and churn it as fast as we can in so many ways.
Printing is good.
Yeah, more money is better.
I would say I'm like discussion with somebody about this whole thing. This was about, sometime last year. I can't remember exactly when it was. But the topic of discussion was how good it is to print the money and how the Fed needs to be doing more of it, and if they did, they'd be saving the economy and so forth. And there was somebody who actually was foolish enough to engage with me. I guess that's the best way to put it. Because I said, well, you know, it's really not too bright because what you end up doing is undermining the value of the currency. And he denied that. And I think he actually cited something that some politician had said to reinforce his viewpoint. So I decided to have a little fun with him. I said, well, okay, but let's assume that you're correct. Why don't we really do it? I mean, up until now, we've been doing it in paltry numbers, you know, like trillions and tens of trillions of dollars. Let's go whole hog here, because there's actually never any inflationary risk, according to your viewpoint, by printing up all this money. So why don't we print up, say, how about $400 to $500 trillion worth of new money? And we'll use like a couple hundred trillion of those dollars to cover all the unfunded mandates for Social Security and Medicare and so forth for the next 100 years. So that emergency will go away, right? And then we'll take the other $300 trillion and we'll divide it among the 300 million people who live in the United States. So that's $1 million apiece. So we'll all be millionaires.
I've always wanted to be a millionaire. That would be my opportunity.
I have to give him credit, too. When I laid it out for him that way, he said, okay, I take it back. You're right. There'd be inflation.
You make too much sense, Walt. Jeez. How dare you use logic on someone?
I know it's scary. But all this conversation about Cyprus and thinking about the fact that they could effectively not only take the money up front, but take it later to the inflation tax, got me wondering, well, how much inflation is going on in Europe? Because I'm pretty sure, like here in the U.S., the official inflation rate is not indicative of what's really going on. I mean, here in the U.S., the official inflation rate is in, what, 1 to 2% range, something like that. Mm-hmm. And, of course, real inflation is probably closer to 10%, and that's on the conservative side. I don't know exactly what it is in Europe, but I know they've been doing a lot of bond buying, and they've been claiming all along that bond buying is not inflationary. So I know there's lying going on there. Not quite sure exactly how much lying. So I actually did a little digging in, because I haven't looked at this in a while. We here on the show haven't looked at it in a while, in terms of how does the ECB, the European Central Bank, work, and how does the money creation cycle work in Europe, and what might the real inflation rate be?
Spoiler alert, you're going to use 27 acronyms, and nobody's going to understand what you're talking about.
Well, that's all right, because they don't understand either.
I looked at the chart, and that was the first thing I noticed, was there was a half dozen different acronyms for different programs that are spewing out money.
EFSM, EIB.
And then you got the other ones on top of that, the IMF and the European Central Bank, ECB, and who knows what else. You know, they got all these little fancy programs.
Well, it's the acronym strategy, you see. See, if you come up with enough acronyms, nobody can figure out what you're doing, so you can try to hide what's going on with the monetary system. I think it's very effective. I don't know about you.
Well, the interesting thing about the chart, it's a big fat chart showing all this data. There were two things that struck me besides the acronyms. One that was that the two stabilization funds, European stabilization funds, have already used half of their funds to bail out Portugal, Ireland, and Greece. So they only got half left. But the even more interesting thing was that when the European Investment Bank itself was established, the criteria, the lending capacity, was capped at 250% of the capital and reserves of every bank in Europe. In other words, they could lend 250%, 2.5 times as much money as they had, just by printing up paper saying, here's the money.
It sounds like a cap to me.
Well, I mean, they're 2.5 times more in debt than they have money to pay it. But that was the original Eurozone agreement, was that the European Central Bank could create this money up to 250 times the assets and so on of all the banks in the Eurozone.
And by the way,
it was designed to inflate.
Bill was making reference to a chart that appears on an article I shared with him, and if you're interested in looking at the article, you can find it at businessinsider.com. It's an article from June 26, 2012, entitled Everything You Need to Know About the European Bailout Mechanisms in One Huge Slide. And they have this infographic-type table, which they're calling a slide, which basically lays out the official mechanism for how they bail out the various European states in trouble. And you correctly pointed out that they've used a path to fund bailing out the smaller countries that are in trouble. If they tried to use the remainder on, say, Italy or Spain, they would just basically wipe it out.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the good thing about Cyprus, if there's any good thing to look at, is it's only like 0.2% of the GDP of Europe. So it's kind of like an afterthought. But it's also, and people may not remember this, the island of Cyprus is divided into two parts, the primary part being Greek Cyprus, which is practically a client state or a puppet of the Greek government.
Mm-hmm.
So when Greece crashes, that 80% of Cyprus crashes. So a lot of the funds that were used to bail out Greece actually ended up going to Cyprus to pay off the debts that Cyprus had bought. So this is really their second go around at taking a little skim off the European banking system. But it's small, so it's nothing to worry about.
Well, that's why they treated it as a test case, because they knew that something this small, you can find out what happens when you try to do this wealth extraction by basically applying an upfront tax during a banking holiday.
But some people have pointed out the moral hazard of it is that if you do it even with this tiny little island nation, you grab deposits that are in people's banking accounts. That becomes an established practice. And
right.
So people in every other country in the Eurozone are saying to themselves, wait a second, you mean tomorrow they could come and grab 10% or 20% or 80% in some cases of the money I've got on deposit in their bank?
Mm-hmm.
Whoa, wait a second.
The really interesting thing is going to be to see what happens over, say, the next 3 to 6 months with the other banks in Europe. Will there be a silent run on the other banks as well?
Yeah, it looks like it's already started. Somebody reported that Italian banks had seen a substantial increase in withdrawals of deposits.
Yep.
And then you've got Spain, you've got Portugal, and who knows what else, after that.
And frankly, they can't handle it, because the more that drain happens, the more that not only the little pigs countries, but the big pigs countries, you got the three little pigs and the three big pigs. the little pigs and the big pigs, they start getting closer and closer to the line really quickly, and it even starts affecting the so-called solvent states, such as, Germany.
Well, it affects states outside of the Eurozone. I think it's something like 30 or 40% of the deposits in Cypriot banks was from Russians. So they're confiscating Russian assets.
Yeah.
So all of a sudden, you know, Russia is, you know, got nothing to do with the Eurozone, but half of the money that it's, you know, big muckamucks have put there to earn this fantastic interest has disappeared.
Yeah, they're not too happy, I don't think, today.
No, they're not happy at all. I guess another portion, you know, 10 or 20% was from Britain. So Britain is not excited about this. And, you know, so they've got to have this bailout. But what they don't like is the fact that what's the terminology for cutting back on spending? Haircut?
I think they call it, what's the word that they use for that? I'm drawing a blank. Isn't that awful?
Yeah, I know. It's you know, it was not frugality, but
austerity.
Austerity, yes. So they moved the austerity from the lower class to the upper class by taking away the assets of all the upper class instead of the lower class. So now everybody's deposit is safe unless they've got more than 100,000 euros in the bank.
Which really pisses off the ex-communist leaders of Russia, who are now the new capitalists, who basically use their new capitalist position to extort tremendous amounts of money from the economy and put it into Cyprus. I mean, what good is it to be an ex-communist turned capitalist if you lose the money? I mean, isn't that the whole point of being an oligarch? You get to keep all the money you stole?
Well, you see, the other amusing aspect of it is that now the banks themselves own the means of production instead of the state. So even though the People's Bank of Cyprus is technically on paper, 83% of it is owned by the government of Cyprus, they've loaned out eight times the amount of GDP for the country. And so the government of Cyprus doesn't have any money to back up that 83% interest. It can't tax, you know, the GDP eight times over to solve the immediate problem.
It
isn't going to work. But the point here of all of this stuff is that the governments are so tied in with the banking system now that the only thing that's building up any kind of confidence is the government's promise, which is, you know, theoretically valid, that all of these debts can be paid back because they have the power to take everybody else's money to pay it. As long as they can tax and increase taxes and confiscate assets and get other people's money, they're good for it. Until the other people run out of money.
So, well, what gets particularly weird is when they start taking the money from the people that they owe it to pay them back.
Yeah, no, it's a crazy, crazy system.
But I was still trying to answer the question of how much real inflation the Eurozone has. Because, again, you try to do some research on this and you find nothing. I mean, there's really nothing published. I have to give the European Central Bank credit because compared to the Fed, which is, by comparison, almost an open-door library, the European Central Bank is so closed-door that finding out anything at all is virtually impossible. Even on their website, you dig through it, and it's like you can find some numbers there, but they're so disparately laid out that, I mean, you could take years putting it together to come up with some sort of a comprehensive and intelligible way of measuring the true inflation rate. And by inflation, I mean, of course, the monetary inflation rate, because that's the one that counts. The closest that I came, and I shared this with you, was a graph that I found at the website SilverLook.com from a post they placed in September of last year entitled "The ECB Managed to Increase Broad Money Supply in the Eurozone but is Unable to Improve Credit Conditions." And there is one graph on that particular page. So the rest of it I didn't really find to be terribly useful, but this one graph was really, really good. The graph, it doesn't even have a whole lot of description to it. It's just described as the ECB balance sheet, and it shows readings between 2009 and 2012 when this thing was published. And what you see around, 2010, no, let's see, I guess halfway through 2011, all of a sudden there's this huge increase in the ECB balance sheet. And it peaks pretty much halfway through 2012. And that, of course, is the bailouts.
Yeah, to simplify
the bailouts hitting the ECB balance sheet in just the same way that the Fed balance sheet got hit when the Fed started bailing out the banks in this country.
Yeah. Now, to simplify the visual image for people, if you just take the beginning and end numbers, the amount of euro currency has doubled since 2009.
Right.
Yeah.
Which isn't as much as the Fed tripling it, but, you know.
Yeah, and the lending of the European Central Bank takes total balance of up to $1.2 trillion of loans to the euro banks. Now, that the amount of loans has tripled since January of 2011.
Yeah.
So it's hard not to call that runaway inflation. I mean, if you double the amount in 3 years and you triple the amount of lending over 2 years, you're increasing the money supply. You're tripling the money supply.
You are.
And that means that the value of every single euro dollar, euro coin, whatever it is, out there has diminished in value by 33% over just 2 years.
And surprisingly, the financial press, they've begun to be aware, at least, that there is a problem with what the Fed has done in this regard in terms of more than tripling their balance sheet, more than tripling, I should say, the monetary base through what they've added to their balance sheet. And you get stuff written about that. You particularly get it on individual blogs, but you also see it occasionally on some of the major blogs and major financial websites. None of them seem to have caught on to the idea that the same thing's happening in Euroland. And I find that to be fascinating. It reinforces for me that so much of what happens, particularly within the U.S. financial system, is dependent upon what the media gives them. And when the media is able to give them more information, in part because more of it's being published by the Fed, it gives them more fodder to work on and so forth. And so it gives them something they can debunk and so forth. And most especially, it gives them the opportunity to say, well, Europe doesn't have this problem. Oh, yes, it does.
Yes, it does. Like I mentioned last week, when the Eurozone was set up, I did not exhaustive, but a little bit of study about what the criteria were. And things like this 250% of GDP lending and the way that the currency was standardized, but the fiscal policy wasn't. And individual countries could borrow as much money as they wanted to, and apparently, it was not supposed to have any effect. And I was surprised that the Eurozone lasted 5 years. Now it seems to be on the verge of crumbling piece by piece, if not altogether.
I actually saw funny commentary on that fact, on the fact that the Eurozone is now 14 years old. And the commentary was basically that it's acting like any 14-year-old. It's awkward. It's socially inept.
I mean, the German banks have a little common sense, and maybe it's because that they read Ludwig von Mises or Mrs. They have a little bit of understanding, and they're being extremely cautious about lending any money from the German banks to the the other foreign banks, because they know exactly what's going to happen.
You got cool that the listeners didn't know what we're talking about. Before the show, Tim and I were texting each other about this conversation I had with a guy who has an alternative currency idea, and he kept pronouncing Ludwig von Mises' last name as Mrs., so that's what Bill's referring to here.
But he's a German economist who understands economics, and I suspect a lot of German bankers have read his original works. Actually, he's one of my favorite philosophers. His book, Human Action, is exceptional. Mm-hmm. It covers not just economics, but all of human motives in the pursuit of benefits and, social intercourse.
It's not for somebody who's interested in light reading, however. It is
not light reading. So anyway, I suspect they read it in the original, and that they're being the Germans totally distinguished from the French or Spaniards or even British are being extremely cautious about protecting their own resources and assets and financial integrity, which is why Angela Merkel is getting all the grief when it comes to austerity or anything else that's being proposed.
It's funny, though, because for a country that is full of people trying to protect themselves, they're doing a damn silly job of, you know, basically bailing everybody out anyway.
Yeah, well, I mean, they get away with it because, you know, when you set up a Eurozone and all these various Euro, you know, bailout funds and everything else, it isn't just them. I mean, Britain has to chip in, and France has to chip in, and Poland has to chip in to bail out all these bad economies.
Well, yes and no on Britain, because they aren't actually part of the Euro.
Well, they're part of the Eurozone, they just aren't part of the Euro currency, or is it vice
right.
versa?
Yeah. And the Euro currency is the actual mechanism used for most of the bailout.
Right.
So, yeah, there's a little thing going on there that kind of gives Britain a bit of a, well, I don't want to say an out, because it's not really an out, but it allows them to at least maintain distance, let's put it that way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's a big political issue as to whether or not they even stay in the Eurozone. Because the Eurozone
it's becoming a big issue as to whether or not anybody's going to stay in the Eurozone.
Yeah, well, I mean, there were good things about the Eurozone, not the Euro itself as a currency, but the Eurozone was basically eliminated almost all tariffs and trade barriers among the various states.
Sure.
So that was something that benefited everybody. But the devil that was in the details of the currency, common currency and monetary controls without any fiscal controls over any of the governments at all. So they were bound to take advantage of that and, you know, put themselves into huge amounts of debt.
And as you pointed out, the European Central Bank and the IMF and the pressure that they placed on Cyprus to accept this so-called haircut, this taking of the upper levels of the deposits in the bank to help cover the expenses, as it were, of the government and the bank itself, that activity has caught a lot of people by surprise.
That they're doing that instead of just a bailout. Well, I mean, the same things happened in previous bailouts when the U.S. government bailed out General Motors. They gave all of the investors and all of the bondholders a huge haircut. They cut like 50% of their assets, claims on General Motors. And that was a huge benefit to the bailout funds, because they took that money and used that to supposedly bail out the TARP fund. So the TARP funds came back, although they were borrowed from a different division of the government, but they came back at the expense of cutting the people who had invested in General Motors for millennia.
But, of course, the big difference is that this time around, well, first of all, that was the United States. I mean, that's another world away from Europe. And second of all, the biggest difference was they went after bank accounts. I mean, it's one thing to go after somebody's shares.
Yeah.
But when you go after a bank account, there's like this emotional tie to bank accounts. Bank accounts are somehow, in most people's minds, separate from other kinds of investment vehicles. Not really investments at all, right? I mean, that's where you store your money. That's all it is. So this becomes a bit of a wake-up call for people when they finally begin to realize, oh, my goodness. I mean, I keep the money in the bank to keep it safe.
And that's the whole bottom line problem with fractional reserve. It just isn't honest. When you give people put money in a bank, you are not, you know, making a deposit. And in spite of whatever claims of insurance coverage for your deposits are, you know, the government might offer, the fact is that they're taking your money and they're investing it. And a lot of them invested poorly. And that's basically the same thing that's happening in Europe. The banks are investing their money poorly, and they're losing it, and that means the depositor's money isn't there anymore.
And I love the phrase you just used, they invested poorly, because that phrase really goes to the heart of what most people interpret the financial crisis of 2008 to be, that it was just poor investment decision. When in actual fact, it is the nature of a fractional reserve system to eventually get to the point where bad lending will happen. It's not that it only happens when people do silly things, when they make stupid decisions. It's that fractional reserve itself is so dependent upon creating money out of thin air, using debt, lending out money that's been created out of thin air through this fractional reserve mechanism, and constantly making as much loans as possible. Eventually, you get to the point where there's not enough people to make the loans to anymore. So you have to expand your pool.
Yeah, I've always thought that the only bank regulation that we ever needed was just a requirement to the bank post on their front door their assets to liabilities ratio. and a little notation that says, if you deposit a dollar here, the best you can expect to receive in return is 55 cents or something equivalent. You know, again, make it clear that it's not a depository, it's an investment. And you're basically investing in the...
It would work, but it's an interesting idea. It'd be fun to see that anyway. It'd be fun to see how people reacted to it.
Well, it'd be kind of like a good housekeeping seal of approval. If the ratio is greater than 50 to 1, you don't put your money there. But, they would never even consider adopting such a simple, straightforward law consumers decide how much risk they want to put their money to.
No. I mean, well. First of all, if that regulation ever did go into effect, which it wouldn't because the banks would never allow it, but if it ever did go into effect, the first thing people would do is go into their banks and say, I want to renegotiate what I'm collecting on this deposit money. If I'm going to take all the risk, I want most of the rewards.
Yeah, there you go. It's an investor. If it was done in an honest fashion, there's nothing wrong with pooling your money together to make risky investments and, either making a lot of money or going broke. But you need to know that that's what you're doing in advance.
Mm, yes.
This pretense that you're making a deposit and the deposit is secure is just a lie. It's fraud. Now, granted, the FDIC is supposedly the insurance for all deposits up to $100,000 or $250,000, whatever it is today. But the fact is that they don't have the money to pay the losses because their reserves are something like 1.5% of the total amount of deposits they're insuring. So they're insuring like $1 trillion worth of deposits under $100,000, and they've only got $100,000 in the bank.
Yeah.
Yep, again, another blatant fraud lie that the deposits are secure.
And it's a legal one. That's the worst part.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, let's take a break, and then after the break, we're going to take a look at something a little bit more on the humorous side regarding what happens in Euroland, and then we'll do a little quick stop off in Iraq before flying back across to our own country here and find out what kind of silliness is happening on this side of the Atlantic. We'll check that out afterwards. Let's take a break. This is the Freedom News Hour, Surviving Meltdown, here on the Progressive Radio Network. We will be right back. Walt and Bill back here on the Freedom News Hour, and as I've mentioned before the break, we've got a rather amusing little tidbit to talk about regarding Euroland, particularly a comment made by an executive, I think from Deutsche Bank, is that right, Bill?
Yeah, right. Yeah, it was Heifetz, is one of the directors of the Deutsche Bank, said the Euro area needs a role model that people across Europe can respect. Quote, I can only think of one figure that is respected by most Europeans and has never sinned. Jesus. So all the Eurozone needs is a second coming of Jesus Christ to save it from itself. What this belies is the whole, magical thinking and miraculous ability of governments to create money out of nothing. Jesus couldn't do that. He tossed the even the coin changers out of the temple.
He did.
But apparently, people believe that governments can do miraculous, wonderful, fantastic things that just seem like magic.
And one could perhaps argue that Jesus had the right idea.
I'm going to hazard a potentially Semitic remark that is fairly common. Jesus saves, Moses invests.
Yes. And I saw that note from you, and it reminded me of something that happened in the early 1970s in New England. If you're a hockey fan, you may remember the name Phil Esposito. He was traded, I think, in the late 60s from the Chicago Blackhawks to the Boston Bruins. And from that point on till, I think, like the late 70s, he was a major force in Boston Bruin hockey. And, of course, they won all those Stanley Cups during that time. He was a defensive man, and he was generally considered to be the best defensive man in the history of the NHL at that point. Well, there was a bumper sticker that was appearing on automobiles throughout the Boston area and even throughout New England. And it was this huge bumper sticker that basically covered most of the bumpers. And, of course, at that time, the cars had really, really large bumpers, not like the cars today. They were, you know, gigantic bumpers. And the bumper sticker said in big letters, "Jesus save." And then in small letters underneath it said, "But Esposito scores on the rebound."
Okay.
Well, that's pretty much what, I mean, the Eurozone should come up with their own version of it. Jesus saves, but Moses invests.
Well, see, all you have to do is just hand over the banks to the churches.
Yeah, that worked really well in Rome.
I mean, they know about this miracle stuff and, you know, how it works, and so they can create money with, you know, from nothing, and there's no problem.
Yeah, I mean, the Curia has done a wonderful job with banking, you know?
Yeah.
How much is this thing? I forget.
Anyway.
Well, before we fly back from Europe, let's take a little stop up in Iraq, because Iraq, of course, is where we saved the Iraqis from the tyrant Saddam Hussein, and thereby prevented the continued increase in al-Qaeda, which had been non-existent before and which, of course, now is running rampant throughout the country. But there are consequences to this wonderful form of world saving, and one of those consequences is economic. Bill, what has happened with the Iraqi economy since we went in and did our wonderful stuff?
Well, I don't know if people remember, but way back when we were talking about invading Iraq, and somebody asked Dick Cheney, "Well, isn't this going to be expensive?" And he said, "No, the Iraqis can pay for it. They've got plenty of oil."
Mm.
And didn't quite work out that way.
Quite.
Because basically they've established an economic dictatorship, and the now the Shiite control the country instead of the Sunnis, and the Shiite are not only confiscating most of the income from the oil supply that they're generating, but they're also inflating their own currency. So there's a big conflict going on between themselves and the main oil suppliers, which is in the Kurdish area. So we're back to the scenario of the country splitting up and the Kurds becoming an independent country because they don't like the way that Iraq is stealing all of their oil reserves. And neither do the various oil companies that have been investing in the Kurdistan areas because they realize there's lots of reserves there. And all of a sudden, no exports from Kurdistan are possible because the Iraqi government says, no, you can't export. And so all the oil's sitting in the ground, and nobody's making any money off the oil. And, of course, nobody is suggesting that Iraq is ever going to pay back the U.S. for saving it from Saddam Hussein. That isn't even on the table.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, essentially, the Kurds and the Sunnis and the oil companies are saying, "Shiite, what happened to all the money?"
Well, the Shiites now control $57 billion worth of money that we gave them. over and above the expense of invading their country, and they're getting an additional $2 billion every year. Well, Maliki puts it in his pocket, passes it around to his political friends, and they're just running a huge, not a con game. What is it called? Plutocracy, I guess, where the in group in the government gets all of the profits from everything, and basically they're robbing the country blind.
So in a sense, we did save Iraq from Saddam Hussein, so we could turn it over to Tammany Hall.
There you go. Or Maliki, whose government is running it.
We'll just call him Boss Maliki, right?
So, this is an interesting sidelight to that, and that is that the Maliki government, because it's Shiite, has sympathies for Iran, and they are allowing Iran to transport weapons to the Syrian regime, the Bashar al-Assad. And so Iraq is in deep diplomatic trouble with the U.S. because they're allowing the Iranians to support the Syrian government. So there's all kinds of complications of having switched one country from one religious group to another religious group. If there was any doubt about total inefficacy of invading Iraq and giving them a wonderful religious constitution and giving them all kinds of aid and support and assistance, yeah, that's what you get.
One of the main reasons that Iran is running those guns through Iraq to Syria and anywhere else they can run guns is because their own economy is in shambles for exactly the same reason. They're running something 25% inflation rate.
Well, the reason for that is because
some way to raise money, you know.
But the reason for that is because basically the U.S. and most of the Western European countries declared war against Iran about 6 years ago. They basically placed an economic embargo on Iran so it couldn't sell its oil. It was able to sell it through China for a while. But basically, it's like surrounding a country with armed military power saying, no, you can't trade with anybody else, and you can't even exchange your... turn in your U.S. Treasury bonds for cash. You can't do anything economically. It's an act of war, and they've done that purely on this pretense that somebody imagines there's a possibility that Iran wants to create a nuclear bomb.
That's right. Yeah, and of course Iran has the totally rational response to that. That we're not going to get the opportunity to engage in any economic activity outside the country. Then no one inside the country can engage in economic activity either. I mean, because that's only fair. So we're going to just jack up the money supply, make it look like we're awash in cash, and then everybody can pay high prices. Yeah, that works.
Well, the problem is that none of the people in the oligarchy and the theocracy and the higher echelons of the government of the bank suffer at all. All the suffering of the economic embargo the U.S. has put on Iran has been moved down to the average common people, and they can barely afford to buy a loaf of bread.
Yeah.
So it's not just war against the ruling elite in Iran, it's a war against the people of Iran, basically destroying the standard of living.
And we're making light of what these governments are doing, but there is, as you point out, there's nothing funny about what is actually happening. I mean, basically, what we're seeing happen in Iraq and Iran is the same thing that we saw happen over the last 10 to 15 years in, say, Afghanistan. And Afghanistan basically has nothing left at this point. There's not even a reasonable mechanism over there you should call an economy anymore. What passes for an economy is basically no more than an opium field, because that's about the best way they can make any money, which is quite pathetic.
When you have a foreign policy, as Dick Cheney summarized it, you do what we want or we're going to roll you back into the Stone Age.
Mm-hmm.
And they succeeded.
And they met
Afghanistan
it.
Back into the Stone Age. And that's where it's at.
In fact, it's the goal of the interventionists to roll everybody back into the Stone Age, because mm-hmm. if everybody's back in the Stone Age, then they have to buy American. I'm not kidding. I'm serious. I think that's a big portion of what it's all about.
However, I just came back from my bathroom and happened to notice a little tag on one of the fabrics that was in the bathroom. Made in Pakistan.
Mm.
Which is, I guess, what we're getting for our $3 billion in economic aid. We're getting cheap towels.
Mm-hmm. Well, that was a good trade. Nice to know we have such savvy traders in charge, don't you think?
Yes, right.
Well, let's look at some more savvy traders. For instance, how about some of the people, the good folks who live north of the border? You actually have a report that says they're richer than we are. How do you come to that conclusion?
Well, it was actually a study that was done. Let me find the information I have here. What they did was they calculated the median wealth of people through all these different countries. Let's see if I can find the actual numbers. As it turned out, the median wealth, which is the if you take the entire population and put them on a scale from, you know, least amount of wealth to the greatest amount of wealth, the median's right in the middle. And what the situation is that Canada, I can't find the number. Canada was something in the neighborhood of 50% higher median wealth
Wow.
than the United States. So even though people in the U.S. think of Canada as just a backwoods country that's going nowhere, they don't have the expense of all these wars, and they don't have any kind of tariffs or trade barriers to the U.S. or Britain or anybody else they trade with. They're doing fine. They're doing, you know, at least 50% better than anybody in the U.S. So I thought that was an interesting median measure of wealth. And this is individual wealth, you know, the net after you take income minus liabilities and assets. So they're much better off than we are.
And I think it's important to note that Canada in and of itself is really no better off than it was, say, 20 years ago. What's happened is that with the massive monetary expansion in this country, we have basically taken a country that was wealthier per capita than Canada and turned it into a country that is poorer per capita. And that's really an extremely important point, because most people don't realize just how much they've been impoverished by what happens with the money supply, because they don't see it. They haven't seen it yet in terms of, well, they're beginning to see it in prices even beyond what the government's willing to admit exists. But for the most part, they aren't really aware on a large scale of just how dramatic the change has been. And again, it's not like Canada doesn't have a lot of the baggage they used to have. They still have their massive health system that's very expensive. They still have a tax structure that's very high, and so on and so forth. It's just that they haven't gotten worse like the U.S. has. And that's really
they haven't done the they haven't had to do the quantitative easing, because in spite of the health costs and other factors, their government basically balances their budget every year. And it isn't exact income outgo, but they are much closer and have much smaller deficits relative to their GDP than the U.S. does, or even Britain does. And so it's they've done some things right and they've done some things wrong. It's just that overall, the average Canadian is doing much, much better than the average American.
Well, that was a fun visit over the border to the north. Let's come back to this country, and we're going to take a look at our friend Ron Paul and his family, because his son is now also in politics and is a U.S. senator from Kentucky. And there is some rather amusing speculation about whether or not Ron's influence on Rand might actually be, you know, from the point of view of conservatives, perhaps counterproductive.
Well, Rand Paul is considered to be far more politically astute than his father was. And so the perspective is that Ron's what? Establishment status as a kook?
Yes, that's a good way.
Is going to rub off on Rand Paul. Now, Rand Paul did something interesting today. He endorsed Mitch McConnell for re-election, which is a purely expedient move. It's possible McConnell has become more libertarian than he was in the past. But it basically cut off the Tea Party and the Liberty Movement's opposition to McConnell in the next election.
Yep.
So it was a very pragmatic thing that people didn't expect when Rand Paul got involved in this. Rand Paul has done some things very similar to what his father has done, the non-interventionist policy. Both the right wing and the left wing are trying their best to characterize Rand Paul as a stealth kook. Bill Kristol called Rand Paul the leading edge of the Code Pink faction of the GOP. Mm-hmm. Of course, a lot of the Republican establishment are in the financial institutions that are getting bailouts and benefits from the current policy. And so, they're afraid that Rand Paul is going to take it a step further than simply auditing the Fed and, actually have them disclose what they're doing on a day-to-day basis. So there's fear on both sides from Rand Paul's rise. And as the perception, at least from the CPAC conference, which was a conservative political action conference, where Rand Paul got more votes than Mario Rubio, he got more views on YouTube of his speech than Rubio did. So it looks, at least at first blush, it looks like a potential contest between Rand and Rubio for the Republican nomination for president the next time around.
And of course, as far out, it's really too far to speculate, but that doesn't stop people from speculating that they love to speculate.
What you do see is you do see movements. Rubio gave his speech, and he basically endorsed everything George Bush ever believed in or the establishment ever believed in. He's basically becoming an establishment candidate who has the benefit of being Hispanic.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore, he's going to get more Hispanic votes so he can take this message to the people and win. And that's the theory of this, the standard GOP country club set,
right.
Is that he can do that. And so Rand is really associating himself with the radicals and the revolutionaries and the libertarians and the young kids and the gays and the, and so on. And it's developing a whole new theme for the idea of being Republican. And that upsets a lot of people, a lot of Republicans.
Oh, yeah.
It also scares a lot of Democrats because they can see that some of his positions, whether it's anti-war or whatever it is, he came out essentially for partial legalization of marijuana or letting the states decide on that issue. That takes away Democratic voters who might have been, single-issue voters on that one topic. So it's going to be an interesting development and to see whether the establishment wins or the revisionists win the next round in the GOP. And whatever the outcome, it will be interesting to see how well they do against Hillary or some other Democratic candidate.
I have to admit, though, speaking as one of the kooks, I have my own concerns about Rand, and I actually like him as a person. I know him well enough that we've spoken on the phone. In my role as the founder of the Nolan Chart website, I've actually talked to him a couple times, particularly during Ron's first presidential campaign.
Mm-hmm.
And we're actually on a first-name basis. I can't say that we're friends, but we're certainly acquainted. He even invited me at one point to be part of his policy want group that where his advisors dish out what they want the media to spit out, and I sat in on one, that was about it.
Yeah.
But the thing I can tell you about Rand is, first of all, everything that you just described fits perfectly with his persona. It's what he's trying to do. But the other thing is, I'm not at all convinced he understands how the monetary system works. And I say that because when I conversed with him on the phone about what his father was doing and pushed him on a few points particularly regarding the free competition and currency act and other things that Ron was pushing, Rand actually gave me a little song and dance that suggested he didn't really understand it.
Yeah.
So I think you may find that there's criticism from both sides, from both the establishment side and from the wacko kooky side.
Well,
he walked that line.
You know, he kind of came from nowhere. He was basically you know, a second fiddle or even a third fiddle to Ron Paul's campaign. Nobody really knew him as, you know, any kind of a, you know, politically astute or, you know, a talented politician until he ran for Senate. I mean, he'd never run for even, you know, city council.
That's right.
Before.
He's an optometrist. Basically.
Never run for anything. And suddenly he wins a Senate seat and is taking full advantage of whatever opportunities he has from being a senator to advance the cause.
We're at the end of the hour, so we can't continue the conversation. We'll have to put off the zombie economics for next time, I'm afraid.
Oh, okay.
But as usual, Bill, it's been a pleasure.
Yep.
And we'll see you all next time here on the Freedom News Hour, Surviving Meltdown. Goodbye, everybody. I'm starting to turn.